Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in today for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call and the Friday Media Roundtable. We look forward to this forum all week because we have a chance here to talk about the emerging stories, local, regional, statewide, national, and international. And this week, there's a great deal happening. The move of the U.S. Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, that intention has caused a spasm of violence in the West Bank, and it's drawn a great deal of criticism from the Pope, to union leaders. It has been a real spasm in terms of coverage, and we're looking forward to talking to journalists about how that has been covered this week. Also, conditions in Yemen have reached crisis proportions, and we'll be joined by a reporter who has covered that in depth. And there's also the fact that there are rumors that U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is on his way out at the U.S. State Department. What are the implications there? I'm joined today by three very knowledgeable journalists. We're going to start with Shireen Tadros. She is the head of the United Nations office in New York for Amnesty, and she's an award-winning journalist. Shireen was the Middle East correspondent for Sky News and Al Jazeera English, and she's one of only two foreign journalists inside Gaza during the Israeli war in the Gaza Strip in the years 2008 and 2009. And Shireen Tadros was honored with a Peabody Award in 2011 for her reporting on the Arab uprisings in Egypt, Yemen, and Libya. And talk about breaking news. Shireen has literally just stepped out of a UN Security Council meeting where Palestine was testifying about the developments this week. So, Shireen, we look forward to hearing the latest. Thanks for being here.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Sarah Obadot. She's the co-producer of a frontline documentary entitled Inside Yemen. The documentary takes a rare, very close-up look at the consequences of more than 2 years of airstrikes on that country by a Saudi-led coalition that is receiving weapons and tactical assistance from the United States. And she's going to help us understand why Americans should care about what's happening in Yemen with their tax dollars. Sarah Obadot, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And in the second half of the program, we'll be joined by Antonio Yuhas. She's a leading author and investigative journalist covering the oil industry. She's a specialist in this subject, and she's written extensively on the influence of big oil. And she's also the author of an article about rumors about Rex Tillerson, and she'll have some insights for us. And we're looking forward to that part of the second half of the program. But I'd love to start with you, Shireen. Again, on Wednesday, Donald Trump announced that the United States will now officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital city of Israel. And he also said he would direct the State Department to start the process of moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And that announcement has generated huge volumes of media coverage. Can you tell us the latest? What was the testimony at the United Nations just moments ago by the Palestinian contingent?
Well, it was around an hour and a half long, this meeting, and it's still going on. And the reason why it's so long is that we started with a briefing from the special coordinator on the Middle East, who really briefed council members as to how serious the situation is now, warning that this uptick in violence could explode further because of Trump's announcement, and really just bringing it home without trying to be non-political about it, the sort of ramifications that we're seeing on the ground, both in the Gaza Strip, in across the occupied West Bank and elsewhere. So that was sort of a dose of realism before the actual meeting began, with all the different interventions by the 15 ambassadors of the Security Council. And what we heard was a chorus of ambassadors from Bolivia to Russia to France to the United Kingdom distanced themselves from Trump's position and the U.S. position of recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. They didn't just say that they disregard this move. But they also then went further and said that their positions have not changed insofar as they recognize that Jerusalem should be settled between the Israelis and the Palestinians in peace negotiations, that no one can unilaterally talk about the status of Jerusalem, and that actually this is, according to international law, occupied territory, the east of Jerusalem, and they still recognize that. They still recognize the annexation of Jerusalem. And that was really important, that the world comes out right now and just says that whatever the U.S. position is on this issue, we still have standards in international law, and international law and U.N. resolutions is unequivocal in this. Jerusalem is occupied territory. The East is has been annexed by Israel, and any determination of the borders of Jerusalem has to be settled by the parties involved and is not up to unilateral declarations by any one state. So that was a very important move that we saw today, and a move that I think was designed to try and calm the extreme tensions that we're seeing across the Arab world right now.
It sounds as if the real development today is that the United States has been placed on an island and isolated from the international community when it comes to this announcement. It sounds as if we're just the rest of the world is simply going to ignore what the United States has just announced. Is that the feeling that you get, and what are the ramifications of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really quite stark for me to sit in a room like I did just now and hear the United Kingdom, a longtime ally of the U.S., and I haven't really seen them diverge on anything else in the year and a half that I've been sitting in that room, to you know, unequivocally say, and Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador, was sitting right next to Matthew Rycroft, the U.K. ambassador, and he just sort of turned to her and said, we do not recognize the decision that the president made yesterday. And behind that, I don't think that there's going to be major, you know, policy changes and disputes between the UK and US. You know, I saw them before the session speaking together, Nikki Haley and Matthew Rycroft. They seem very comfortable together. I don't think that this is a diplomatic spat. But I do think that states felt with this one they have to come out, because this is a no-brainer. You know, there is no question that Jerusalem, that East Jerusalem is occupied, and that it's not unified, and that it's not recognized as the capital of Israel. And you know, no matter what one state says, that's the fact. And so I don't see a big diplomatic fallout from this, but yes, I think states made it very clear today that this is unhelpful, and they're not joining in.
You touched on the history briefly, but once again, just kind of a thumbnail sketch. West Jerusalem was seized by Israel in the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, and about 750,000 Palestinians were expelled from what was historic Palestine. That time was referred to as the Nakba, or the catastrophe, when Israel officially was founded. And subsequently, Israel occupied and annexed the eastern part of Jerusalem after the military victory of the 1967 war. But its control over East Jerusalem has never really been recognized by the international community. So that's kind of a thumbnail sketch, and it's been so ever since. And it's been a subject of repeated negotiations that apparently have gone nowhere, but it is the stake in the ground that both Israelis and Palestinians have claimed. So can you just talk about, I know a lot of the coverage has been about the reaction of Israelis, but not to Palestinians. So can you talk about what life is like post this announcement, Shireen?
You know, I've got to say it's really interesting, because on the one hand, I watch a lot of the media coverage of this, and I have friends who are journalists in Jerusalem, and we can clearly see the burning tires and the days of rage that have been announced. And, you know, and I don't want to in any way take away from the seriousness of that, because that, you know, Jerusalem being a tinderbox and that area in general, things can always escalate very fast. However, I have to say that in private conversations I've had with Palestinian friends in the last 48 hours, there's also a different side of this. There's a side of this where Palestinians, certainly some of the ones I'm speaking to, which are, you know, you could talk about that, maybe the intelligentsia, who are saying, well, this has always been the U.S.'s position, whether it's stated or not. That's how they've seen Jerusalem. They are not a neutral broker in this. And by saying that, you know, by some sort of determining one of the biggest final status issues in the peace negotiations, they're sort of putting a nail in the coffin of the two-state solution. So by doing this, they, you know, a lot of the Palestinians I was speaking to were saying, well, maybe this blasts the whole thing open. Maybe now we can start talking about a one-state solution. Maybe now things will get shaken up. The U.S. is not an honest broker anymore. Someone else can step into the fold. I mean, there were no peace negotiations. Nothing is happening right now. So it's not as if, you know, Trump's announcement has put, you know, a big spanner in the works. There were no works. So I think there's a glass half full approach to this, which is at least it shakes up the situation. It brings much needed attention on the plight of the Palestinians, both in the Gaza Strip and across the West Bank. And maybe something will come out of this.
It's an interesting take, because that's exactly the position that's taken by two authors of the online magazine 972mag.com, one Jewish, one Palestinian. And their article says that Trump is simply confirming what Israelis and Palestinians already know. And they write, quote, "Headlines and experts have warned that President Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and eventually move the American embassy there is a catastrophe and upends decades of American policy that will kill the peace process." Well, from the ground, it doesn't look like Trump is breaking with U.S. policy, but rather authenticating it. And he can't kill the peace process, since it's been dead for a long time anyway. Trump moves, his move, in fact, confirms everything we Israelis and Palestinians already know and have known for a while. So, again, maybe this is designed to be a shakeup. Sarah Obadat, what are your thoughts on the fact that this might be just the shakeup that's needed, particularly since the Trump administration has signaled that they're planning to release a new Middle East peace plan sometime in the near future?
I mean, in terms of where I'm standing, and I actually haven't been able to report on this issue as closely, but just from where I'm standing and in terms of the fact that I follow the region, this is sort of something that as Shireen said, is not really going to. People are trying to denounce it. Everyone but the U.S. nobody's really following it. But at the same time, what's sad about this is that people are actually listening to what the United States is saying. And I think this is one of the issues: is that no matter what, even if what President Trump announced won't really make a difference in terms of how the international community will see Jerusalem, at the end of the day, people react and people are listening to what the United States is saying, and we're seeing protests in places like Jordan and other places in the Arab world. I mean, the United States, I think, sometimes underestimates the fact that their word actually carries a lot of weight in the region. And while some of these policies or some of these statements might be seen as distracting, it definitely affects the morale of the people in the region and the people who are waiting for change.
Well, he's certainly not the first president to promise this. There's even a suggestion that President Obama, his immediate predecessor, had pretty much said the same thing, as have other previous presidents. But the question for me is, and for maybe a lot of folks, is why now? Why now? What's the point of this timing? The Hanukkah celebration at the White House was quite celebratory. There are a lot of folks who really were looking forward to this, especially with the appointment of the ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, very right-wing in his thinking. Shireen Tadros, do you have a feel for the why now of this announcement?
I mean, I wonder whether we look more domestically than internationally for the answer to that, because one of the first things that Trump said in his announcement was that previous presidents, as you just said, had promised this, and I have promised this in my campaign, but no one's followed through. I am following through. Nikki Haley just now, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., said almost the exact same words as her sort of opening lines. So So clearly there's a domestic angle to this, where Trump is ticking one of his campaign pledges away at a time when he's not really able to tick anything else in terms of domestic legislation that is being blocked here constantly. There's also deflection from huge troubles he's having here at home, whether it's the Russia investigation or problems at Congress. So I tend to think that a lot of the U.S. administration's moves are more designed for domestic consumption and to deflect, rather than a really sort of more international perspective. But we also have to keep in mind that in the lead up to this, this didn't come out of nowhere. He made a trip to Saudi Arabia, the Vatican, and Jordan. That was very clearly lining up something on Jerusalem. I think we have to look at Jared Kushner's role in this as well, and his proximity to certain leaders, and how much he has President Trump's ear. All of that are no doubt factors as well.
Let's move on now. And I'm sorry, please go right ahead, Sarah.
No, and I agree. I agree with what Jean's saying. And I think also it's just important to remember that the Palestinian cause right now on the priority list for the region itself has kind of been downplayed, been replaced. It slipped in terms of importance. It was replaced by various uprisings. It was replaced by what's going on in Syria. It's been replaced by what's happening in Yemen. Saudi Arabia is focused on Iran and is very keen to strike a deal with those who will share their thoughts and their vision for what to do with Iran and what to do with Iran's regional dominance. Mm-hmm. And so in many ways, this is also an opportune time for those who are trying to shift the focus or trying to alter the deals in favor of one side over another.
All right, let's move on now and talk about the worsening humanitarian crisis in Yemen. For the most part, it's been absent from coverage in the U.S. media. Sarah, you were part of the frontline team that were able to go in. Very few journalists have been allowed to enter Yemen. Let's start with how you got in.
Well, it was a process that actually took us months and months. I think it was 3 months of a full-time job trying to get into Yemen. And the reason is basically because the airport and the flights going in and out of northern Yemen have now been confined to just United Nations flights. The Saudi-led coalition controls the airspace, and so they review the manifest and the flight manifests of the United Nations and basically decide who gets to go in and who doesn't. Ever since the malnutrition videos that came out at the end of 2016, there's been sort of a systematic decision to prevent media from coming in, because that would criticize the coalition's management of the war. So in order to get in, it was actually a very intense and tedious bureaucratic process where we had to get a visa from both governments, the government in exile and the Houthis. And then once we got those, we had to basically convince the UN to let us in. And after we made our way to Djibouti, which is the only place where we could fly from, the coalition actually prevented us the first time from going in. I'm lucky that I was with a reporter who has had a lot of experience in the region and had a lot of contacts with Saudi Arabia. We were just reporting in Saudi Arabia before we got into Yemen, and so they had actually encouraged us to go see it when we challenged them on the policies of the Yemen war. And so we were able to sort of fall back on that. But not a lot of journalists have the time or the resources to be able to fight for this kind of access, which has basically affected the coverage of the war significantly, which basically is why it's been so underreported.
And it has indeed been underreported. You know, there's so much that's vying for our attention that this humanitarian crisis is literally flying under the radar. Just briefly, the Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula is based in Yemen, and the United States is backing Saudi Arabia as it flies sorties into Yemen, killing civilians. So that's kind of literally a 10-second explanation. But suddenly Monday, all of a sudden, Yemen was shoved up to the top of the headlines. when Ali Abdullah Saleh, Yemen's former dictator, was killed outside Sana'a, the capital. And the video of that, of his bloody body wrapped in a blanket, began circulating online. And suddenly people were asking, wait a minute, Yemen, where is it? What's happening there? And why should we be concerned? So, Shireen, you've also covered this issue. How do you figure that the U.S. is, this involvement of the U.S. isn't being covered more by the media?
I think that Yemen is not a forgotten war, actually. It's an ignored war. And there is a difference. There are huge access issues, both for journalists and also for humanitarians and rights investigators. Us as Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International have not been able to enter the country for many months. The last time I was there was last year, but I got in three times as a journalist last year, wasn't able once to go in as a human rights investigator since I joined Amnesty. So there are huge access issues for everyone at the moment. I do think that there was a slight change, which I think we should talk about, which is on after Ali Abdullah Saleh's assassination, the UN called a special briefing, and it was behind closed doors. But we do know what happened, and they did release what they call press elements afterwards. And the Security Council united in saying that this is the biggest humanitarian catastrophe the world is seeing. Something has to be done. That they're very worried about the situation. That the blockade has to end. And quite strong language. And then after that, on Wednesday, we saw the U.S. State Department release a short but very important statement about the fact that Saudi Arabia is responsible for this blockade and it must lift the blockade. I mean, I think that was somewhat with what the Saudi king had said about Jerusalem an hour before, but whatever the underlying reasons for that statement, it was a very strong statement that we haven't heard from the U.S. before. And the U.S.'s, including, and the U.K.'s involvement in the Yemen war isn't just supplying supplying these arms deals and sorties with their planes. They're actually in the war rooms. I mean, there is a direct line there which makes them complicit, even under international law, in what's going on and the deaths. So I think increasingly it's becoming a very uncomfortable positioning as the UN takes up this issue more and more, and we start talking about accountability for these countries, including the US and the UK. Now, how that translates into actual action, so we stop seeing this arm flow and these deals taking place with Saudi Arabia, I don't know how it's going to pan out. But I do think that there's been a change, and the only way to keep that up is to keep domestic pressure up in the US, in the UK, against the coalition, and have people more outraged. And that's why it's really important that journalists have that kind of access.
Sarah Obadat, you certainly could not have had better timing with your frontline documentary, Inside Yemen. The blockade by Saudi Arabia has cut off fuel for hospitals and water pumps and vital aid supplies for children, who are the most vulnerable victims. Can you talk about the impact on children of this situation?
The impact on children, yeah, of course. I mean, it's also important to acknowledge that Yemen was always poor. It's always been poor, even prior to the war. And so the war has certainly made things a lot worse. I mean, there used to be a malnutrition issue in the country, but of course now it's gotten a lot worse. And the reason is when infrastructure is continuously bombed, whether it's bridges that connect people from one town to another to get to the hospital, whether it's hospitals themselves, things are being bombed and people are afraid to travel. I mean, I remember being in a hospital in the second poorest district of Yemen, Hajja, where we saw little girls that were coming in that were not from that town. They had to travel deep to get to the hospital. The reason being was either because one of them was terrified to go to the MSF hospital in her area because that hospital itself had been bombed. Another one just, it took them days to get there because the main bridge that connected them to the hospital was bombed. I mean, this little things like this obviously affect the well-being of children. You also have the government in exile had moved the central bank from Sana'a to Aden. This means that government employees themselves have not been paid or had not been paid in 8 months when I was there in May. And this also affects people's ability to do things like buy food and provide for their families. I mean, children and women in Yemen have been the most vulnerable during this conflict.
And though, of course, that imagery is the kind of thing that would get people's attention, but access is difficult, which makes it all the more remarkable, Sarah, that you were able to get in as part of your documentary. This, we've been talking with Sarah Obadat. She is the co-producer of the Frontline documentary. It's called Inside Yemen. It takes a rare close-up look at the circumstances of the 2 years plus of airstrikes on Yemen by Saudi-led coalitions that are receiving weapons and tactical assistance from the United States with U.S. tax dollars. Thank you so much, Sarah Obadat, and also joined by Shireen Tadros, just fresh out of the United Nations Security Council meeting where Palestine was testifying about the reported move of the U.S. Embassy in Israel. Thank you so much. Thank you both. We appreciate you being here. We're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we're going to talk about rumors of Rex Tillerson's ouster. Are they true? Stay tuned.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio. There are many ways you can take part in the conversation. On the phone by sending an email to yourcall@klw.org or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A. Stay with us.
Thanks for staying with us. I'm Renee Kemp. If you're just joining us, this is the Friday Media Roundtable here on Your Call, and we're going to devote the second half of today's program to talk about Rex W. Tillerson. And we have with us a journalist who has had the opportunity to really look into who he is, what his tenure has meant at the U.S. State Department, and is it true that he's leaving, and what happens if he does? Antonia Juhas is a leading author and investigative journalist covering the oil industry. She's written extensively on the influence of big oil and the intersection between oil companies and the U.S. government, including recent protests at Standing Rock. She's the author of three books, including her most recent. It's called Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Antonia Juhas, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Just last week, the New York Times reported that the White House has developed a plan to force Secretary of State Tillerson out. We all know that his relationship with Donald Trump has been strained. There are reports that he would be replaced with, let's say, a sycophant, Mike Pompeo, the current CIA director. There's a real love fest between Pompeo and Trump. It apparently could happen right around the first of the year, just in the next few weeks. And last year, you wrote a piece describing Tillerson as possibly the most dangerous Secretary of State ever. So let's start with that description. Mm-hmm. Why did you describe him as such?
And of course, we'll be able to go back to the last half hour, because of course that also is quite relevant in discussions of Tillerson and the State Department and U.S. foreign policy. And, you know, tragically, it's all linked. So Rex Tillerson had spent his entire professional career at ExxonMobil from when he left college, rising through ExxonMobil, including heading ExxonMobil's Yemen division, including heading ExxonMobil's Russia division before becoming president and then CEO of the company. He faced forced retirement from that position of CEO just in time to become named Secretary of State for Donald Trump.
Was he being forced into retirement by age or company by policy?
Age. Yeah, company okay. policy on age. Okay. So when his name was first floated, it was definitely during a period of time when we could, I guess, still be astonished by things related to the Trump administration. And my first question, honestly, when his name came up, was why would he take a demotion from CEO of ExxonMobil to be United States Secretary of State? And that's when the issue of learning about the forced retirement made that make some sort of sense, which was that he had to leave that position in any case. My view on why he was named as Secretary of State and then why he accepted the position is primarily that he has served the function of being essentially the Bush administration's man in the Trump White House. He is the connector to that side of the establishment Republican Party and just the agenda of the George W. Bush administration and the members of it, of which he was a huge backer, into the Trump administration. And that he has been able to hold his place within the administration. He never liked Donald Trump. Donald Trump never liked him. He personally didn't support Donald Trump in the campaign. The oil industry didn't support Donald Trump at the beginning. More broadly, the oil industry supported Jeb Bush for president. And then when he fell out of the race, the industry really put its energy behind Congress and ensuring Republican control of Congress, which, of course, they got. And then secondarily supported Clinton, but not nearly in the type of dollars or energy as they had done with campaigns previously. But he entered the Trump administration, I believe, to achieve goals of the Bush administration, but also to achieve goals that he had for ExxonMobil, and that he felt that he could achieve those goals from within the Bush administration. So there was, within the Trump administration. So there was both a personal interest in being Secretary of State for goals that he sought to achieve, and that he was holding this position that I think, basically a deal was struck with Trump, with these Bush-era establishment Republicans, that Tillerson would be the person that they had within this administration. I believe that Tillerson is a significantly more powerful man than Donald Trump. And my view on the back and forth about whether he would stay in his position as Secretary of State, which has been going back and forth from the very beginning, this has been a constant rumor and a constant issue being reported on. When is Tillerson going to leave?
But what makes him more powerful in your mind than Donald Trump?
As CEO of ExxonMobil, there's a well-known book on ExxonMobil, the title of which is Private Empire. ExxonMobil was, for a significant period of time, it's the largest descendant of the Standard Oil Company, which was the largest, most powerful corporation in the United States and in the world for a significant period of time. Its largest corporate descendants were Exxon and Mobil, which then merged to become ExxonMobil. And ExxonMobil carried on that mantle of being the nation's and the world's one of its most powerful companies, and for a significant period of time until Apple recently superseded it, was the most profitable corporation the world had ever known for many years running. ExxonMobil guided in many ways U.S. policy, and that reached a real pinnacle within the George W. Bush administration until the Trump administration, where now we actually have, as opposed to sort of doing the guiding from the background, the CEO of ExxonMobil as Secretary of State. Tillerson has a much longer history and relationship as a more powerful player standing up against many governments around the world from his former seat as CEO of ExxonMobil, making decisions that affect foreign militaries, foreign policy, foreign economies in a way that Donald Trump could never have even aspired to in his previous roles prior to becoming president of the United States. Trump led a very insular in many ways life. I would say, you know, one of his more crowning achievements was The Apprentice television show and, you know, some money made in real estate. But it in no way was his sort of position as a power player in the world anything remotely close to that, which was exercised by Tillerson.
And Tillerson has been something of an enigma because he had never run for public office. He'd only worked for a private corporation, one corporation, all of his adult and professional life, which is extraordinary in and of itself. But there was nothing for people to latch on to. And then, of course, once he became Secretary of State, he was even more of an enigma. He didn't let the press travel with him on the plane. He didn't answer questions. He didn't have press conferences. But can you determine, or in your reporting, how his influence may be playing out in foreign and domestic policy in the Trump administration?
I'd say that's been one of the biggest problems or benefits to Rex Tillerson, but enormous problems to policy and the public, is this idea of Tillerson as an enigma. He's been an enigma to political reporters who are used to covering politicians. One of the problems that we have in our media is the siloing of journalism, where you have one set of reporters who cover politics in D.C., another set of reporters who cover politics outside of D.C., one set of reporters who cover the environment, another set of reporters who cover the climate, another set who cover health, another set who cover foreign policy, another set who cover the oil industry. So anyone who's ever covered the oil industry or looked at the interrelationship between all of those issues, which, you know, obviously the previous journalists on the show did, and I try and do, and, you know, some of the best journalists do, anyone who's ever covered the oil industry had no mystery about Rex Tillerson, who he is, what he could do, and what his agenda was coming into Secretary of State. He was a mystery to politics reporters who didn't understand him, didn't understand someone who... So even if there's been former CEOs, and we've had many, who have been held high office within the U.S. government, generally what's been understood is their personal financial stakes of the policies that they were seeking to implement. And Tillerson had done this very public divestment of a lot of his personal stakes in ExxonMobil, although they were simply actually deferred for 10 years, so not completely erased as they were reported, just deferred for 10 years. But that made him seem like an enigma. If he's not in it for personal gain, then what is he in it for? So that's where, if you understand the oil industry, he's not an enigma. He is ExxonMobil. Its fate is his understanding of his fate. And him spending his entire life at ExxonMobil, professional life, is not rare at all in the oil industry. It's very common in the oil industry. People go in young, they stay in, and they make their way to the tops of companies. It's very typical. And they see themselves as part of a culture. And particularly ExxonMobil is quite well known for this, having its own cultural identity that is imbued in oil. And part of that strong cultural identity does come from these roots of Standard Oil, one of the most famous, powerful companies we've ever had. And then ExxonMobil is the descendant of that, and there's a very strong tie to it. So Tillerson's agenda coming in was things that were very important to ExxonMobil, which were a relationship with Russia, which he had spent over a decade establishing, and gaining access to oil fields, which were cut off to ExxonMobil as a result of Obama's putting in place sanctions against Russia for Crimea. Tillerson had personally spent a decade of his time negotiating enormous deals for ExxonMobil, which made it so that Exxon's Russian holdings were five times larger than its holdings anywhere else in the world. Its second largest holdings, five times smaller, are in the United States. So its fate is much more tied to those fields in Russia than it is in many ways to the United States. But all of that work was essentially for naught when Obama put in place sanctions barring ExxonMobil and Russia's ability to make use of those fields, many of which are in the Arctic Ocean. That was very troubling for Vladimir Putin, who needs that oil. He wants that oil. He wants that money. He has put the fate of Russia on oil. And that was also deeply problematic for Rex Tillerson and ExxonMobil. And one of his agenda items coming in to be Secretary of State was to reforge that tie with Russia that was less strong under the Obama administration. That tie with Russia is obviously something that permeates a great deal of the Trump administration and its campaign, and to get those sanctions removed. The other key policy agenda, one of them for ExxonMobil, which is also deeply tied to the Bush administration and many members of the Trump administration as well, is Iran, is gaining access to Iran's oil by negotiation if possible, and if not, an Iraq model. Because if we recall, after Iraq, the Bush administration was quite clear that Iran was next on its agenda. That was not that was public. And that was stopped primarily because Americans had no more taste for war. And also there were some impracticalities about how a war would unfold.
Well, let me just say, so far, just based on that, I'm trying to figure out why these two men, why Donald Trump and Rex Tillerson, would be at loggerheads. They seem to be of a mind on these things. We're talking, if you're just joining us, with Antonia Juhas. She's an author and investigative journalist covering the oil industry, and she's going to try to shed some light on who is this Rex Tillerson. What happens if he leaves? The number is 866-798-8255, and you can email us your call at kalw.org. And so, because these two seem to be of a mind on these issues, why are they at loggerheads? Why might he be on his way out? And by the way, what do you think of that rumor? Is it true?
So first on that rumor, so I would never say never with the Trump administration. I think we've learned that. It's difficult to predict the actions that Trump is going to take. And one of the reasons why is because he has motivations that are coming at him from many different avenues. And one of those motivations is maintaining his domestic support. And his domestic support comes from a teeny tiny extremist group of people and power players within the United States whose views are quite extreme and antithetical to the majority of Americans. And he makes moves that represent that teeny tiny sliver of support. And as that support gets smaller and smaller, and within a tighter extremist group of people, Trump's actions are also less predictable. And so there are things that Trump does that follow that agenda, which I just laid out, around Iran, around Russia. And there's things that he does that can make a lot of that worse. And that oil agenda is sometimes something that Trump follows, and it's sometimes something that he does a poor job with. So if I answered first the question of, do I think Tillerson is out?
Yes.
So what I have said about Tillerson from the beginning, as I said at the beginning here, I think he's a much more powerful man than Donald Trump. I think his supporters are in general much more powerful people than Trump supporters. But of course, we're in a strange time in American history. I think that Tillerson will leave when Tillerson decides to. So I think if Tillerson has come to a decision, or comes to one, that being associated with the Trump administration is more detrimental to him than beneficial to achieving his goals, then he'll leave. If he decides that he needs to stay in to achieve his goals, or those behind him decide that he needs to stay in some ways to act as potentially have a calming effect, if possible, in some ways, sort of a strange choice of words, on the Trump administration, then he'll stay in. Now, for example, this move on Jerusalem. The move on Jerusalem is pure Kushner. And that is an agenda item for Trump's son-in-law that is highly detrimental to many other views that the Trump administration is supposed to have, and is certainly detrimental to views that Tillerson has for maintaining a certain level of calm within the Middle East, for alliances with the So there's a new prince who's making big moves in Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. That prince seems to have a fairly close relationship with Jared Kushner. Those moves are different than his predecessors. Tillerson's alliance are with his predecessors.
Oh, I see. So there's a divergence.
There's a potential divergence.
I see.
And so
okay.
This move on Jerusalem, for example, could be extremely detrimental to many of the alliances that Tillerson has forged and wants to see maintained.
Because it's destabilizing oil-producing countries where he would like to be able to do business.
Yes.
Got it. Okay. And I imagine it doesn't hurt a bit that Tillerson allegedly called Trump a moron. I imagine...
He called him an effing moron.
I think we're allowed
publicly
to say that
I said
on public
effing.
Radio.
No, I mean, that's sort of amazing. I mean, to be honest. And he wasn't removed after that. Now, maybe, you know, some people say it's the kind of tough talk that Donald Trump likes. I don't think Donald Trump likes that kind of tough talk directed at him. He, after that exchange... talked to the press and kept reiterating, you know, he said, I'll take an IQ test against Rex Tillerson. He also kept coming into the press saying, you know, I'm really smart. I went to an Ivy League school. I'm really smart. I don't think Trump liked that was publicly known, that that's what he was called. And Tillerson didn't move. Tillerson is also decimating the State Department. I think he cares not at all about the State Department. If he has any feeling towards the State Department, is that he would prefer that it was and is moving in the direction of being dramatically smaller and weaker and less influential than it has been, because he would prefer a corporate agenda and the ability of corporations to act more freely. And he has decimated staffing, he's decimated funding. And he has his own little isolated group of a team that he listens to. And that team is who he moves around making decisions with. And I think we know very little about what he's actually been up to as Secretary of State. As you said in the outset, he has primarily eschewed speaking with the media, except when he, you know, goes out and does a press offensive. So after the last sort of round of speculation about him potentially being out, he sat down with the New Yorker. He sat down with the New York Times. He sat down with Bloomberg. These were interviews that he arranged. And he had conversations that he wanted to have. And those were, that was his agenda, how he wanted to have stories written in the press. And so I think we know very little about what he's been up to. One of the things that would be good if he did in fact leave and was in fact replaced is perhaps we get a clearer view of what he's been doing. We know that he spends a lot of time, I guess, as most Secretary of States do, speaking on the sidelines with world leaders at meetings that he's at. So we get, we know that he's been speaking with Lavrov. We know that he's been speaking about the Ukraine. We know that he... is meeting with world leaders on the sidelines of international meetings, and those meetings, those discussions are about things like, as I said, the Ukraine, about Russia, about Iran, probably about Yemen. And every once in a while, he makes a public action, which is then very troubling. So, for example, one of the public actions he did recently do was announcing that the United States was pulling out of the United Nations negotiations on an agreement on migrants, which was one of the first steps to an international agreement on for both migrants and for refugees, making actionable commitments on how we're going to address a global refugee and migrant crisis. And now the United States, as announced by Tillerson, is out of that entire United Nations negotiating process.
And add that to the other list, the Paris Climate Accord. The administration has stacked the administration with oil and gas and coal-friendly politicians and executives. Trump has approved the Keystone XL pipeline, the Tenet the Senate tax bill that they're currently considering would allow oil drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The Trump administration, through the Bureau of Land Management, is set to auction off 10 million acres in the National Petroleum Reserve in the western part of Alaska's North Slope. I mean, I could go on, but that seems like the most recent thing in a string of things. Is Tillerson the architect behind all of this?
No, I think Tillerson, I mean, so the Trump administration, so I wrote my first book is actually called The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time. My second book is called The Tyranny of Oil. I've spent a lot of time looking at the relationship of U.S. governments to the oil industry. And I thought with the Bush administration that we had reached the pinnacle of oil interests intermingling with the federal government. The Trump administration has surpassed that, but it's far less uniform in the way that it exercises that oil agenda. And Tillerson is far from being alone, in how those policies are being implemented. And honestly, I think that Tillerson is focused to a large degree on foreign policy. And the domestic policy, you've got lots of other oily people at work.
I see what you did.
See what you got there. Mm-hmm. From Rick Perry and Scott Pruitt and now Ryan Zinke, there is a long list of and Harold Hamm in the background, who's someone we don't talk about nearly enough, who is, I think, a key driver on Trump's domestic oil agenda.
But we're missing so much, Antonia. You focus on this. Like you said, there are reporting silos.
That's right.
And health reporters report on health. And so how concerned are you that we are missing a lot when it comes to what's under Rex Tillerson's purview? Everything from fossil fuels and the XL pipeline to the wilderness to migrant policy. We're missing a lot, are we not?
I think if you look at the entire Trump administration and fossil fuels, it's impossible to keep up, to be honest. There are so many, I would say, fronts under attack on an international level and a domestic level. I think, basically it was put quite clearly by the Interior Department when Zinke has said now over and over again that achieving American energy dominance is the goal of the Interior Department, not American energy independence, which is something that, as a phrase, that had been used quite a bit, but dominance. And this goes hand in hand with another sort of extremist strain within the Trump administration, which is Kathleen Hartnett White, who's now being considered. She's about to go up for a full Senate vote as the head of the Council on Environmental Quality, White House Council on Environmental Quality. She's part of this strain of extremist fossil fuel advocates who come out of Texas, which is also where Tillerson comes out of. And they see it's tied to the white nationalism of the Trump administration. So they refer to something which they call the master resource. And that is fossil fuels. And they use that phrase unironically and talk about white men who have led the American fossil fuel development and will continue to do so, and making use of the master resource fossil fuels to lead to American energy dominance in the world.
Not independence, but dominance
in the world.
I think the most incredible thing that you said was if Tillerson does in fact leave, it'll be by his choice, and that he is by far more powerful than the president of the United States. Very telling. The original OG oil gangster. It's amazing. We hope you'll pick up Antonia Juhas's book. It's called Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. We were also joined this hour by Shireen Tadros from the UN Security Council hallway, where she gave us the latest on what's happening with Palestine, testifying there about the developments this week in Israel. And also want to thank Sarah Obadot, co-producer of the Frontline documentary Inside Yemen. Thank you so much, all of you, for being here. You can listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast. Visit yourcallradio.org Find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. Follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio and email shows and feedback. Maliha Razizan produced today's show. Phil Hartman is the chief engineer. Thanks for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.